speeches are based on conversations that took place over a period of 18 months with the president, with most members of his senior staff, some of whom talked to me dozens of times, and with many people who they in turn spoke to. The first interview occurred well before I could have imagined a Trump White House, much less a book about it. It took place in late May 2016 at Trump's home in Beverly Hills. The then candidate polishing off a pint of Häagen-Dazs vanilla as he happily and idly opined about a range of topics, while his aides, Hope Hicks, Corey Lewandowski, and Jared Kushner, went in and out of the room. Conversations with members of the campaign's team continued through the Republican convention in Cleveland, when it was still hardly possible to conceive of Trump's election. They moved on to Trump Tower with a voluble Steve Bannon before the election, when he still seemed like an entertaining oddity, and later, after the election, when Bannon seemed like a miracle worker. Shortly after January 20th, I took up something like a semi-permanent seat on a couch in the West Wing. Since then, I have conducted more than 200 interviews. While the Trump administration has made hostility to the press a virtual policy, it has also been more open to the media than any White House in recent memory. In the beginning, I sought a level of formal access to the White House, something of a fly-on-the-wall status. The president himself encouraged this idea. But given the many fiefdoms in the Trump White House that came into open conflict from the first days of the administration, there seemed no one person able to make this happen. But equally, there was no one to say, go away. Hence, I became more a constant interloper than an invited guest, something quite close to an actual fly on the wall. In this role, I accepted no rules nor made any promises about what I might write or what I might not write. Many of the accounts of what has happened in the Trump White House are in conflict with one another. Many, in Trumpian fashion, are baldly untrue. Those conflicts and the looseness with the truth, if not with reality itself, are an elemental thread of the book. Sometimes I have let the players offer their versions, in turn allowing you, the reader, to judge them. In other instances, I have, through a consistency in accounts and through sources I have come to trust, settled on a version of events I believed true. Some of my sources spoke to me on so-called deep background, a convention of contemporary political books that allows for a disembodied description of events provided by an unnamed witness to them. I have also relied on off-the-record interviews, allowing a source to provide a direct quote with the understanding that it was not for attribution. Other sources spoke to me with the understanding that the material in the interviews would not become public until the book came out. Finally, some sources spoke forthrightly on the record. At the same time, it is worth noting some of the journalistic conundrums that I faced when dealing with the Trump administration, many of them the result of the White House's absence of official procedures and the lack of experience of its principals. These challenges have included dealing with off-the-record or deep background material that was later casually put on the record. Sources who provided accounts in confidence and subsequently shared them widely, as though liberated by their first utterances. A frequent inattention to setting any parameters on the use of a conversation. A source's views being so well known and widely shared that it would be risible not to credit them. And the almost samizdat sharing or gobsmacked retelling of otherwise private and deep background conversations. And everywhere in this story is the president's own constant, tireless, uncontrolled voice, public and private, shared by others on a daily basis, sometimes virtually as he utters it. For whatever reason, almost everyone I contacted, senior members,